Hello and welcome to Assumptions, a series about the rights and wrongs of jumping to conclusions. We all make assumptions. Drummers aren't too bright, blondes have more fun, freedom is good, sugar is bad, and the ABC would only give a radio show to someone who knows what they're doing. Often, they're so entrenched we're not even aware of them. I'm Susan Carlin and I'm here to test the things we hold dear and work out where the truth lies. Coming up on today's episode, what a load of rubbish. Is a full bin each week just a fact of life these days?
In Australia, we generate just over 2 kilograms of waste per person per day.
And dishing the dirt on what it means to be Australian.
And racists. They've been making the biggest assumptions of all. I know, who would have thought racists would make assumptions? Just because I'm Muslim doesn't mean I support ISIS. I mean, some of us like Al-Qaeda.
But first, boy, do I have a dodgy deal for you. Corruption. The word conjures up images of shady backroom dealings and mysterious envelopes exchanged in parking lots. It has a reek about it that invades our nostrils and our news hours, and it makes the common decent folk like you and I shudder. But let me ask you, is one person's bribe just another person's boozy long lunch? Possibly. We assume that corruption is always bad, but is it? Joining me to walk this crooked mile is Seth Kaplan, author and lecturer at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University in the United States. Seth, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
So, how would you define corruption?
Well, unfortunately, in the English language, we group a very wide range of activities under the definition of corruption. So, for example, corruption in China may be simply a tax on doing business in many cases and not change the outcome of an activity. But corruption in Nigeria could be so destructive that the activity that someone is supposed to do may never occur. We have to be very careful when you use this word because it really includes many, many different meanings.
So do you have any examples from your own business dealings about a time where you saw that it was working positively?
Well, I lived in China for 7 years. And in China, you obviously have some corrupt, bad business practices, but there are also times where taking people to lunch, maybe giving them a little bit of money for their family might make it easier to do business, might build trust. In the short term, they can actually help business people do business, help a country attract investment. It has some positive aspect to it that might not occur otherwise.
Those practices are obviously viewed positively or benignly in China. If those similar things happened in the United States, for example, would it be viewed similarly positively or benignly?
No, obviously in a well-developed country, it's considered a very bad thing, and we're better for the fact that our economy is more efficient. But we're a very developed country, and we're more the exception than the rule in the world. If you look at politics, even in the most developed countries, there is certainly a degree of corruption in terms of companies or individuals giving money to politicians in return for them voting certain way, helping companies or individuals get access to power in certain ways. I mean, that is not defined as corruption in our countries, but certainly has a degree of corruption in these actions.
In that situation, then, have we just simply institutionalized corruption or legitimized it?
That's a very good way to look at it. I mean, the United States, our politics has become corrupt to a certain degree, whether it's the way legislation is written, the way legislation is interpreted. There is a degree of corruption in how our government works, which may not be the case in a country like Singapore, may not be the case in a country like Norway or the United Kingdom. Yet we are not considered a corrupt country. So on the other hand, if you look at China, it is a country that is as corrupt as many African countries or Middle Eastern countries, yet the government is high capacity and does very well. So we have to be very careful about how we analyze and how we rank these countries.
Do you think that we are more willing to criticize from afar other countries? Oh, they're so corrupt, not like us. Look at the way that dysfunctional government works. It's appalling. Why do we seem to be so more acutely aware of it in other countries than we are in our own circumstances?
Well, I mean, to a certain extent, it does exist more in other countries, but there's a natural tendency to assume that our country is best. And I think in the West, there's a natural tendency to assume that all countries are going to evolve to reach a better situation. So I think that's a very natural tendency that we have. And I'm not sure that's always accurate.
Can you give us any examples of times when corruption might be good or useful?
A famous example is your northern neighbor, Indonesia, under Suharto, extremely corrupt, but business people invested a lot. The government reduced poverty a lot, and stability was ensured for 30 years in this partnership between business people, government, and some technocratic officials. And Indonesia reduced poverty by over $100 million, but it was a form of highly centralized corruption that allowed that to happen. And I don't think that would have happened unless there was that system in place.
It's been said that our attitude towards corruption in some Western societies is something of a fetish. You know, we feel the same way towards corruption as we do towards countries where people don't queue up properly, and we get very cross about this. We get angry when we travel overseas and have to pay off an official so we can get on a boat or get a stamp in our passport. But we don't have any problem with tipping a waiter in the US because we understand that their wages probably aren't enough for them to live off. Why do you think we have this attitude in some Western countries like Australia?
The tipping is a really good example because I think this idea of tipping, you could argue it is a form of corruption, that we have to pay somebody for our service. We don't think of it as corruption, but if you were tipping at a government office, why is that different than tipping a waiter? So I think that's a really good example of how social norms influence perceptions. But there certainly is a fetish about corruption. And I think we need to think of corruption as a symptom of underlying social dynamics and not in itself a good or bad thing. Of course, sometimes it is bad, but it's a result of what happens in the society. It's a social norm. It's a result of bad institutions. It's a result of how people must act to survive sometimes. There's many things going on in a country that lead to these different types of corruption, but corruption itself is more a result of what is happening in a society, not the cause of what is going on in society.
So what do you think that says about us as Australians or Americans? Why do we assume always, almost unquestioningly, that corruption is always bad?
Again, this goes back, what is corruption? I would say some things that we do are very bad. They lead to bad outcomes, and that is corrupt practices. But there's a lot of things we do that are social norms. There's some countries where you give some money in a red envelope and you expect good treatment, like a government official. And in Australia, you give a gift to someone because you hope that they will treat you well. So is the red envelope with cash corruption and your gift not corruption? So these things vary a lot, and we need to differentiate between things that are always destructive and things that simply are a way of doing business, or things that possibly could be positive in some cases.
Seth, this has been absolutely fascinating. I am so grateful for your time, and I can assure you that the red envelope of cash that I have for you is going to be coming your way. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Seth Kaplan, author and lecturer in the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University in the United States. And you're with me, Susan Carland, on Assumptions at RN. And now to an expert in pushing the envelope. Comedian Nazeem Hussain joins me for a segment we call Tell Us What You Really Think. It's a cosy little place where we encourage a special guest to share with us some assumptions that really get their goat.
Susan, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about assumptions that people make that really annoy me. All right, let's start off with assumptions that people make about what it means to look and be Australian. I'll give you an example. My little sister, she had a pen pal way back when she was in year 8. in Japan. They used to write back and forth to each other. You remember pen pals?
Right,
it was
yeah.
like social networking before social networking. Except you only got one follower out of it, right? About 8 letters into this pen pal relationship, they decided they were going to swap photographs. My sister, she received a photo of a Japanese pen pal, then she took a photo of herself and sent it straight back to Japan. All of a sudden, her pen pal just stopped replying to my sister. No more letters after that. Broke my sister's heart. Think what you like. Pretty obvious. My sister's pen pal made an assumption. She felt ripped off. She wanted a real Australian. Instead, she obviously thought her pen pal had been outsourced to India. She's like, where the hell is Sally from Home and Away? I hate that Japanese girl. Hate her family. Can't eat sushi anymore. I get flashbacks. Susan, another thing, right? More assumptions that annoy me. You know, ever since ISIS hit the charts at the start of last year, people have been making all sorts of dumb assumptions about Muslims. To be honest, it's almost worse than immediately post 9/11. I had this one girl come up to me recently and say this. She was like, oh, Nazim, you're Muslim, which means we could never go on a date because Muslims aren't allowed to go on dates, right? Ridiculous, because we are allowed to go on dates. I said, I'd take you on a date. I said, you know, on a candlelight dinner, I'd be sitting there gazing at you. You'd be sitting there across the table, gazing straight back at me and my mum and my dad, the overseas guests as well, right? I guess what I would probably call a date in your culture, I said, you might call a wedding, perhaps. Assumptions. You know what she might call date number one, I'd call wife number one. Like, so quick to make these assumptions. Another thing, another guy came up to me recently and he said, oh, this is after ISIS did something crazy in the news again. He said, oh, hey, Nazim, can I ask you a serious question? You're Muslim. Does that mean you support ISIS? And I was like, what? Now, that's ridiculous, right? Because that basically means that all Muslims think the same. They're all part of some sort of monolith that we all support and follow the same groups. But that's crazy. Just because I'm Muslim doesn't mean I support ISIS. I mean, some of us like Al-Qaeda. Just stupid, just a bunch of together like that. Made the biggest assumption, right? You shouldn't be laughing, Susan. Like, it's terrible.
Just... I have my face in my hands at this point.
And racists. They've been making the biggest assumptions of all. I know. Who would have thought racists would make assumptions? Last year, this actually happened. Some angry racists, they wanted to take out their racism on some Muslims. So instead of just attacking the most vulnerable members of the Muslim community as they normally do, Muslim women who wear headscarves or hijabs or niqabs or burqas, instead they attacked a Sikh temple in Perth with anti-Muslim, anti-Arab graffiti. Now, for those of you who don't know who Sikhs are, I'm not going to make any assumptions. Sikhs are those people from India who are not Muslim. Just to clarify, the height of misassumption. It got so ridiculous that after their Gurdwara got attacked, a Sikh community leader actually did an interview clarifying. He said, we just want to make it very clear that we are not Muslim. We have very different turbans and very different practices. If you like, we can draw a diagram for you. These are the brown people that are bad, and these are the good brown people, the Sikhs. So stop making dumb assumptions.
That was comedian Nazim Hussain. And if you want to tell the world what you really think, head on over to the RN Facebook page. I'm Susan Carland. Don't you love bin night? Trying to cram all your weekly rubbish into the bin is like trying to fit a troop of 38 circus clowns into a mini. Actually, that's quite entertaining. Bin night's not entertaining. Why do we have so much rubbish? And why are council bins getting smaller by the week? I swear, ours is the size of a thimble. It's impossible to get it all in. Or am I doing it all wrong? Assumptions producer Rachel Carbonell hit the streets in search of a fellow citizen who puts the rest of us to shame by living almost rubbish free.
I'm standing outside a major national supermarket chain where I am meeting a woman I've known for a very long time, Arwen Birch. She's kindly agreed to take me shopping with her so that she can demonstrate to me and the rest of us how she manages to live her life producing very little rubbish. Hi, Arwen.
Hi, Rachel.
Thanks for taking me shopping with you. How much rubbish do you think you make in a week?
Probably half a supermarket bag full.
For a family of how many?
We have 2 kids, a husband and a sister.
That really isn't very much rubbish at all. How do you achieve that?
A lot of it is just habit, and I don't give it a lot of thought, and I don't feel like I do anything special or any extra effort. But then when I sat down and started going through it one by one, I did come up with a lot of things.
And so do you think it's a lot of little things that all add up, or do you do big things?
Oh, there's a few big things. I compost my own food scraps, which I think is a lot of people still don't do, and that's one of the simplest and one of the most heavy things in your rubbish bin is often your food scraps. But after that, it's, yeah, it is probably a whole whole heap of little things.
Why have you made the choice to live your life like that?
It was because I heard facts like we are running out of place to put our landfill, where every time a tip fills up, we need to find somewhere else to put it. No one wants to live next to a landfill, so it's getting harder and harder to find places to put our rubbish.
Why do you think there is that assumption that it's impossible to live your life without filling that bin, or even that it's okay to fill your bin every week?
Well, I guess it's accepted. That's the bin size you get given from your council, and they collect it every week, so that's the expectation that that's a reasonable thing to do, I guess. All the options are out there. There's still a lot of, when you go into the shops and when you see advertising for what sort of products you should be buying, and when you buy new things, and you're always encouraged to buy new things and buy more things. Every time you get those things, they're wrapped up in polystyrene and lots of different packaging, and that's all available. It's there on the middle shelf saying buy me.
How much of your rubbish do you recycle?
The council I live in actually recycles flimsy plastic, and obviously still produce a lot of that. I'm no saint, but that can now go in the recycling bin in Moreland anyway. But even my recycling bin, I would only half fill it every week.
And is recycling the great answer to making less rubbish, do you think?
I think it's better than landfill, but I think it is a huge cost to the environment still, with the trucking it and the melting it down and remaking it into new things.
Let's go. You've got your green bag here.
Yeah, a couple of green bags. Green bags have individual other little plastic bags in them that I might fill up when I go and do the bulk shopping. I'll get some lentils and other things.
So where are we headed first?
Well, I need to buy burritos today, so that's my crime of the day. I'm actually getting burritos in packets.
What sorts of ways do you minimise packaging when you're at the supermarket?
I'm always looking for things that are big. So a big bag of rice that's on special, or a big 1 kilo packet of cheese. Oh, yay! The cheese that I got is on special. So I get the Australian made, it's on special, and I get the 1 kilo block.
And so that just means that you're buying it once rather than four times with four lots of packaging?
Correct.
Now, I know that you don't generally buy your produce from supermarkets, but today you're going to get some beans.
Yeah, I need some beans for my dinner tonight, so I have brought along, let's see, it's an old bread bag, and I've got it out, and I'll get my beans in it. I often get sort of funny looks sometimes from the checkout people when I hand over. Sometimes they actually scan the barcode without thinking about what they're doing, and I say, no, they're beans. I'm just reusing my bag. To give you an idea of how uncommon these sort of little things are.
And what do you reckon consumer habits are like these days in terms of the bags that we put all of our shopping in?
I think, unfortunately, it's still the minority that are doing the green bags. It's a lot more common than it used to be. But I still think most people just grab bags.
Now that's obviously not all of your shopping. Where are we off to now?
We're going to head over to Ceres, which is a local environment park that it has organic fruit and veg and a bulk food store at it. So we have a lovely, colourful line of plastic receptacles that are full with various things, rice, lentils, there is some oats.
And it's all in bulk, basically, so you can buy as much or as little.
You bring along your own packaging, and then you pull the lever and it fills up, like so.
Of course, you've got to have access to a bulk food shop.
Yeah, well, I've got a local Lebanese guy who's just set up his shop in my local mall, and I didn't know about the shop, but I went in one day and went, oh, there's a whole heap of bulk foods here that I didn't know about. So sometimes you can find them in the non-hippie parts of the world.
So you don't have to be an inner urban hippie like you in order to reduce your rubbish footprint.
No, and a lot of it is just not buying things in the first place, which obviously doesn't cost any time. It actually saves you money.
Oh, I love trash.
That was producer Rachel Carbonell with Melbourne woman Arwen Birch rubbishing our assumptions about waste, and I have to say I certainly feel a tad guilty about now. What do we think happens to our rubbish once we've put it on the curb for collection, or if you live in the country, you've driven it to your local landfill? Joining me to discuss this is senior research scientist in oceans and atmosphere at the CSIRO, Denise Hardesty. So, Denise, what is the problem with filling our bins each week?
In Australia, we generate just over 2 kilograms of waste per person per day. That's pretty amazing, especially when you think about the fact that so much of our waste is actually plastic, and plastic is pretty lightweight. So when you think about weight and then you think about the volume of some of this stuff, that's pretty confronting, I think.
How do we compare to other countries? Are we, other similarly industrialized countries, are we big producers of rubbish?
We produce less rubbish per person than they do in New Zealand, and slightly less than they do in the United States. But we produce more rubbish than some of the nearby island countries, or, you know, some of the developing nations. So developing nations tend to have proportionately more waste that they call mismanaged. So it's not going to the landfill or the tip. It may be falling off the sides of trucks, or, you know, ending up down the stormwater drains and those sorts of things. So we're doing pretty well with that. But when you actually think about how much the total volume is, so they estimate that just plastic litter within Australia is around 38,000 kilograms per day.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. When you think about, again, how lightweight our plastic is, and plastic, so much of, you know, the waste that we produce and what gets lost out there into the environment and what can affect our wildlife and can have, you know, health effects as well.
What are the environmental effects of our rubbish?
So our rubbish affects animals. So if we care about biodiversity, so it affects our marine wildlife, for example, as well as, you know, animals that live on land. Animals get tangled up in our rubbish and they mistake it for food and they eat a plastic diet. So I've seen seabirds eat everything from toothbrushes to cigarette lighters to rubber balloons, you know, these wonderful items that are used for celebrations or for sporting events, and they release them with helium in them and they float out to sea and birds accidentally eat them. And, you know, that can cause all sorts of problems, obviously, for wildlife.
So do you think we like to think of ourselves as greener than we actually are? Like, oh, but I recycle so much, so, you know, I think I'm really doing my bit for the environment. Do you think we do that?
Absolutely. I mean, who wants to think of us as doing the wrong thing or being the bad guy, right? I mean, that's not a nice thing, and we do pretty well. You know, most of us, we take care of our environment. We wouldn't have our kids' litter. We wouldn't chuck stuff on the side of the road, those sorts of things. So, yeah, I think in general, we want to think we're doing the right thing, and I think most of us do or try to. Honestly, I think we're so, it's so fraught with some of these things. Like, did you know, so what kind of, what brand of toothpaste do you use?
Colgate. And we allowed to say that on ABC? I don't know. Anyway, okay. I use a well-known brand.
So if you use a well-known brand of toothpaste, does it have some of those sort of whitening or shiny or any of those sort of flecks or
everything in it? I think it's stronger than my toilet cleaner.
So did you know that you are brushing your teeth with plastic?
No, I did not know that.
So there are these wonderful cleaning plastic particles called microbeads that are in so many of our cleaning supplies. If you use, they have little tiny beads of plastic, and that's what we're cleaning our teeth with and washing our faces with. So it's really everywhere.
Do things like microbeads have a big impact on the environment, or is it just the culmination of that with all the other plastics that we produce?
That's a really big question. We're still struggling as scientists to get a handle on how much input is there that's going out into the oceans and out into our lakes and that sort of thing, you know, because we're finding that we can find higher counts of plastic floating in the ocean than we do plankton, which is at the bottom of the food chain. If you're an animal and you're in the ocean and you're mistakenly eating this plastic, you can get all sorts of environmental accumulation from negative chemicals or toxins potentially. And so we're starting to look to see how's that transmitting up the food chain.
Denise, thank you so much for your thoughts on rubbish. Denise Hardesty is the senior researcher in oceans and atmosphere at the CSIRO.
Thank you. A pleasure to talk to you today.
Sadly, we've run out of time to trash any more assumptions, but it doesn't have to be goodbye now. Good gracious, no. Head over to the RN Facebook page and let us know what you really think. Or you can leave little love messages for the producer. Or hate mail. She can take it. That's what she gets the big bucks for. The podcast of this show can be downloaded from the ABC RN page by searching Assumptions, or you can follow me or RN on Twitter. So many ways to stay in touch. I assume you're writing all this down. Join us next time as we delve once more into the deep, mystical waters of the assumptions we all make. But until then, I'm Susan Carland, and you've been listening to Assumptions on RN.